Chapter 11. Jack Renault. What the next development of the conversation would have been, I cannot say, for at that moment the door was thrown open violently, and a tall young man strode into the room. Just for a moment I had the uncanny sensation that the dead man had come to life again. Then I realized that this dark head was untouched with grey, and that in point of fact it was a mere boy who now burst in among us with so little ceremony. He went straight to Mrs. Renault, with an impetuosity that took no heed of the presence of others.
"Mother! Jack!"
With a cry she folded him in her arms.
"My dearest! But what brings you here? You were to sail on the Anzora from Cherbourg 2 days ago."
Then, suddenly recalling to herself the presence of others, she turned with a certain dignity.
"My son, monsieur."
"Aha!" said Monsieur Hoté, acknowledging the young man's bow. "So you did not sail on the Anzora?"
"No, monsieur. As I was about to explain, the Anzora was detained 24 hours through engine trouble. I should have sailed last night instead of the night before, but happening to buy an evening paper, I saw in it an account of the awful tragedy that had befallen us."
His voice broke and the tears came into his eyes.
"My poor father! My poor, poor father!"
Staring at him like one in a dream, Mrs. Renault repeated,
"So, you did not sail?"
And then, with a gesture of infinite weariness, she murmured as though to herself,
"After all, it does not matter. Now."
"Sit down, Monsieur Renault, I beg of you," said Monsieur Hoté, indicating a chair. "My sympathy for you is profound. It must have been a terrible shock to you to learn the news as you did. However, it is most fortunate that you were prevented from sailing. I am in hopes that you may be able to give us just the information we need to clear up this mystery."
"I am at your disposal, monsieur. Ask me any questions you please."
"To begin with, I understand that this journey was being undertaken at your father's request."
"Quite so, monsieur. I received a telegram bidding me to proceed without delay to Buenos Aires, and from thence via the Andes to Valparaiso and on to Santiago."
"Ah. And the object of this journey?"
"I have no idea."
"What?"
"No. See, here in the telegram."
The magistrate took it and read it aloud.
"Proceed immediately, Cherbourg. Embark Anzora, sailing tonight, Buenos Aires. Ultimate destination, Santiago. Further instructions will await you, Buenos Aires. Do not fail. Matter is of utmost importance. Renault." "And there had been no previous correspondence on the matter?"
Jack Renault shook his head.
"That's the only intimation of any kind. I knew, of course, that my father, having lived so long out there, had necessarily many interests in South America, but he had never mooted any suggestion of sending me out."
"You have, of course, been a good deal in South America, Monsieur Renault."
"I was there as a child, but I was educated in England, and spent most of my holidays in that country, so I really know far less of South America than might be supposed. You see, the war broke out when I was 17.
"You served in the English Flying Corps, did you not?"
"Yes, monsieur."
Monsieur Hoté nodded his head and proceeded with his inquiries along the, by now, well-known lines. In response, Jack Renault declared definitely that he knew nothing of any enmity his father might have incurred in the city of Santiago or elsewhere in the South American continent, that he had noticed no change in his father's manner of late, and that he had never heard him refer to a secret. He had regarded the mission to South America as connected with business interests. As Monsieur Hoté paused for a minute, the quiet voice of Giraud broke in.
"I should like to put a few questions of my own, Monsieur le Juge."
"By all means, Monsieur Giraud, if you wish," said the magistrate coldly.
Giraud edged his chair a little nearer to the table.
"Were you on good terms with your father, Monsieur Renault?"
"Certainly I was,"
returned the lad haughtily.
"You assert that positively?"
"Yes."
"No little disputes, eh?"
Jack shrugged his shoulders. "Everyone may have a difference of opinion now and again."
"Quite so, quite so. But if anyone were to assert that you had a violent quarrel with your father on the eve of your departure for Paris, that person without doubt would be lying?"
I could not but admire the ingenuity of Giraud. His boast, "I know everything," had been no idle one.
Jack Renault was clearly disconcerted by the question. We
did have an argument, he admitted.
Ah, an argument. In the course of that argument, did you use this phrase? When you are dead, I can do as I please?
I may have done, muttered the other.
I don't know. In response to that, did your father say, but I am not dead yet? To which you responded, I wish you were?
The boy made no answer. His hands fiddled nervously with the things on the table in front of him.
I must request an answer, please, Monsieur Renault, said Giraud sharply.
With an angry exclamation, the boy swept a heavy paper knife to the floor.
What does it matter? You might as well know.
Yes, I did quarrel with my father. I dare say I said all those things. I was so angry I cannot even remember what I said. I was furious. I could almost have killed him at that moment. There, make the most of that.
He leant back in his chair, flushed and defiant. Giraud smiled. Then, moving his chair back a little, he said,
That is all. You would, without doubt, prefer to continue the interrogatory, Monsieur Hotet.
Ah, yes, exactly, said Monsieur Hotet. And what was the subject of your quarrel?
That I decline to state.
Monsieur Hotet sat up in his chair.
Monsieur Renault, it is not permitted to trifle with the law, he thundered. What was the subject of the quarrel?
Young Renault remained silent, his boyish face sullen and overcast. But another voice spoke, imperturbable and calm, the voice of Hercule Poirot.
I will inform you, if you like, monsieur.
You know?
Certainly I know. The subject of the quarrel was Mademoiselle Marthe Dubreuil.
Renault sprang round, startled. The magistrate leaned forward.
Is that so, monsieur?
Jack Renault bowed his head.
Yes, he admitted. I love Mademoiselle Dubreuil, and I wish to marry her. When I informed my father of the fact, he flew at once into a violent rage. Naturally, I could not stand hearing the girl I loved insulted, and I, too, lost my temper.
Monsieur Hotet looked across at Mrs. Renault.
You were aware of this attachment, madame?
I feared it,
she replied simply.
Mother, cried the boy, you too. Marta is as good as she is beautiful. What can you have against her?
I have nothing against Mademoiselle Dubreuil in any way, but I should prefer you to marry an Englishwoman. Or if a Frenchwoman, not one who has a mother of doubtful antecedents.
Her rancor against the older woman showed plainly in her voice, and I could well understand that it must have been a bitter blow to her when her only son showed signs of falling in love with the daughter of her rival. Mrs. Renault continued, addressing the magistrate,
I ought perhaps to have spoken to my husband on the subject, but I hoped that it was only a boy and a girl flirtation which would blow over all the quicker if no notice was taken of it. I blame myself now for my silence, but my husband, as I told you, had seemed so anxious and careworn, different altogether from his normal self, that I was chiefly concerned not to give him any additional worry.
Monsieur Hotet nodded.
When you informed your father of your intentions towards Mademoiselle Dubreuil, he resumed, he was surprised?
He seemed completely taken aback. Then he ordered me peremptorily to dismiss any such idea from my mind. He would never give his consent to such a marriage. Nettled, I demanded what he had against Mademoiselle Dubreuil. To that he could give no satisfactory reply, but spoke in slighting terms of the mystery surrounding the lives of the mother and the daughter. I answered that I was marrying Marta, and not her antecedents, but he shouted me down, with a peremptory refusal to discuss the matter in any way. The whole thing must be given up. The injustice and high-handedness of it all maddened me, especially since he himself always seemed to go out of his way to be attentive to the Dubreuils, and was always suggesting that they should be asked to the house. I lost my head, and we quarrelled in earnest. My father reminded me that I was entirely dependent on him, and it must have been in answer to that that I made the remark about doing as I pleased after his death.
Poirot interrupted with a quick question.
You were aware, then, of the terms of your father's will?
I knew that he had left half his fortune to me, the other half in trust for my mother, to come to me at her death, replied the lad.
Proceed with your story, said the magistrate.
After that, we shouted at each other in sheer rage until I suddenly realized that I was in danger of missing my train to Paris. I had to run for the station, still in a white heat of fury. However, once well away, I calmed down. I wrote to Marta, telling her what had happened, and her reply soothed me still further. She pointed out to me that we had only to be steadfast, and any opposition was bound to give way at last. Our affection for each other must be tried and proved, and when my parents realized that it was no light infatuation on my part, they would doubtless relent towards us. Of course, to her, I had not dwelt on my father's principal objection to the match. I soon saw that I should do my cause no good by violence.
To pass on to another matter, you are acquainted with the name of Duveen, Monsieur Renaud?
Duveen, said Jack. Duveen? He leant forward and slowly picked up the paper knife he had swept from the table. As he lifted his head, his eyes met the watching ones of Giraud.
Duveen?
No, I can't say I do.
Will you read this letter, Monsieur Renaud, and tell me if you have any idea as to who the person was who addressed it to your father?
Jack Renaud took the letter and read it through, the colour mounting in his face as he did so.
"Addressed to my father?"
The emotion and indignation in his tones were evident.
"Yes, we found it in the pocket of his coat."
"Does—"
He hesitated, throwing the merest fraction of a glance towards his mother. The magistrate understood.
"As yet, no. Can you give us any clue as to the writer?"
"I have no idea whatsoever."
Monsieur Hoté sighed.
"A most mysterious case. Ah, well, I suppose we can now rule out the letter altogether. Let me see. Where were we? Ah, the weapon. I fear this may give you pain, Monsieur Renaud. I understand it was a present from you to your mother. Very sad. Very distressing."
Jack Renaud leaned forward. His face, which had flushed during the perusal of the letter, was now deadly white.
"Do you mean that it was with an aeroplane wire paper cutter that my father was killed? But it's impossible. A little thing like that—"
"Alas, Monsieur Renaud, it is only too true. An ideal little tool, I fear. Sharp and easy to handle."
"Where is it? Can I see it? Is it still in the body?"
"Oh, no. It has been removed. You would like to see it, to make sure? It would be as well, perhaps, though Madame has already identified it. Still, Monsieur Bex, might I trouble you?"
"Certainly. I will fetch it immediately."
"Would it not be better to take Monsieur Renaud to the shed?" suggested Giraud smoothly. "Without doubt he would wish to see his father's body."
The boy made a shivering gesture of negation, and the magistrate, always disposed to cross Giraud whenever possible, replied,
"But no. Not at present. Monsieur Bex will be so kind as to bring it to us here."
The commissary left the room. Stoner crossed to Jack and wrung him by the hand. Poirot had risen, and was adjusting a pair of candlesticks that struck his trained eye as being a shade askew. The magistrate was reading the mysterious love letter through a last time, clinging desperately to his first theory of jealousy and a stab in the back. Suddenly the door burst open, and the commissary rushed in.
"Monsieur le juge! Monsieur le juge!"
"But yes, what is it?"
"The dagger! It is gone!"
"What? Gone?"
"Vanished, disappeared. The glass jar that contained it is empty."
"What?"
I cried. "Impossible! Why, only this morning I saw—"
The words died on my tongue, but the attention of the entire room was diverted to me.
"What is it you say?"
cried the commissary.
"This morning?"
"I saw it there this morning," I said slowly.
"About an hour and a half ago, to be accurate." "You went to the shed, then? How did you get the key?"
"I asked the Sergeant de Ville for it."
"And you went there? Why?"
I hesitated, but in the end I decided that the only thing to do was to make a clean breast of it.
"Monsieur Hoté," I said, "I have committed a grave fault, for which I must crave your indulgence."
"Proceed, monsieur."
"The fact of the matter is," I said, wishing myself anywhere else but where I was, "that I met a young lady, an acquaintance of mine. She displayed a great desire to see everything that was to be seen, and I... Well, in short, I took the key to show her the body.
Ah! Cried the magistrate indignantly. But it is a grave fault you have committed there, Captain Hastings. It is altogether most irregular. You should not have permitted yourself this folly.
I know, I said meekly. Nothing that you can say could be too severe, monsieur.
You did not invite this lady to come here?
Oh, certainly not. I met her quite by accident. She's an English lady who happens to be staying in Merlinville, though I was not aware of that until my unexpected meeting with her.
Well, well, said the magistrate, softening. It was most irregular. But the lady is without doubt young and beautiful. What it is to be young!
And he sighed sentimentally. But the commissary, less romantic and more practical, took up the tale.
But you did not reclose and lock the door when you departed?
That's just it, I said slowly. That's what I blame myself for terribly. My friend was upset at the sight. She nearly fainted. I got her some brandy and water, and then afterwards insisted on accompanying her back to the town. In the excitement, I forgot to relock the door. I only did so when I got back to the villa.
Then for 20 minutes
at least,
said the commissary slowly. He stopped. Exactly, I said.
20 minutes, mused the commissary.
It is deplorable,
said Monsieur Hoté, his sternness of manner returning.
Without precedent.
Suddenly another voice spoke.
You find it deplorable? Asked Giraud.
Certainly I do.
I find it admirable,
said the other, imperturbably. This unexpected ally quite bewildered me.
Admirable, Monsieur Giraud?
Asked the magistrate, studying him cautiously out of the corner of his eye.
Precisely.
And why?
Because we know now that the assassin, or an accomplice of the assassin, has been near the villa only an hour ago. It will be strange if with that knowledge we do not shortly lay hands upon him.
There was a note of menace in his voice. He continued, He risked a good deal to gain possession of that dagger.
Perhaps he feared that fingerprints might be discovered on it.
Poirot turned to Bex.
You said there were none?
Giraud shrugged his shoulders.
Perhaps he could not be sure.
Poirot looked at him. You are wrong, Monsieur Giraud. The assassin wore gloves, so he must have been sure.
I do not say it was the assassin himself. It may have been an accomplice who was not aware of that fact.
The magistrate's clerk was gathering up the papers on the table. Monsieur Hoté addressed us.
Our work here is finished. Perhaps, Monsieur Renaud, you will listen while your evidence is read over to you. I have purposely kept all the proceedings as informal as possible. I have been called original in my methods, but I maintain that there is much to be said for originality. The case is now in the clever hands of the renowned Monsieur Giraud. He will, without doubt, distinguish himself. Indeed, I wonder that he has not already laid his hands upon the murderers. Madame, again let me assure you of my heartfelt sympathy. Monsieur, I wish you all good day.
And accompanied by his clerk and the commissary, he took his departure. Poirot tugged out that large turnip of a watch of his and observed the time.
Let us return to the hotel for lunch, my friend, he said, and you shall recount to me in full the indiscretions of this morning. No one is observing us. We need make no adieu.
We went quietly out of the room. The examining magistrate had just driven off in his car. I was going down the steps when Poirot's voice arrested me.
One little moment, my friend.
Dexterously, he whipped out his yard measure and proceeded quite solemnly to measure an overcoat hanging in the hall from the collar to the hem. I had not seen it hanging there before and guessed that it belonged to either Mr. Stoner or Jack Renault. Then, with a little satisfied grunt, Poirot returned the measure to his pocket and followed me out into the open air.
Chapter 12. Poirot elucidates certain points.
Why did you measure that overcoat? I asked, with some curiosity, as we walked down the hot white road at a leisurely pace.
Parbleu! To see how long it was,
replied my friend imperturbably. I was vexed. Poirot's incurable habit of making a mystery out of nothing never failed to irritate me. I relapsed into silence, and followed a train of thought of my own. Although I had not noticed them specially at the time, certain words Mrs. Renault had addressed to her son now recurred to me, fraught with a new significance. "So you did not sail," she had said, and then had added, "After all, it does not matter. Now." What had she meant by that? The words were enigmatical, significant. Was it possible that she knew more than we supposed? She had denied all knowledge of the mysterious mission with which her husband was to have entrusted his son, but was she really less ignorant than she pretended? Could she enlighten us if she chose? And was her silence part of a carefully thought-out and preconceived plan? The more I thought about it, the more I was convinced that I was right. Mrs. Renault knew more than she chose to tell. In her surprise at seeing her son, she had momentarily betrayed herself. I felt convinced that she knew, if not the assassins, at least the motive for the assassination. But some very powerful considerations must keep her silent. "You think profoundly, my friend," remarked Poirot, breaking in upon my reflections. "What is it that intrigues you so?" I told him, sure of my ground, though feeling expectant that he would ridicule my suspicions. But to my surprise, he nodded thoughtfully. "You are quite right, Hastings. From the beginning, I have been sure that she was keeping something back. At first, I suspected her, if not of inspiring, at least of conniving at the crime." "You suspected her," I cried, "but certainly. She benefits enormously. In fact, by this new will, she is the only person to benefit. So from the start, she was singled out for attention. You may have noticed that I took an early opportunity of examining her wrists. I wished to see whether there was any possibility that she had gagged and bound herself. Eh bien, I saw at once that there was no fake. The cords had actually been drawn so tight as to cut into the flesh. That ruled out the possibility of her having committed the crime single-handed. But it was still possible for her to have connived at it, or to have been the instigator with an accomplice. Moreover, the story, as she told it, was singularly familiar to me. The masked men, that she could not recognize, the mention of the secret. I had heard or read all these things before. Another little detail confirmed my belief that she was not speaking the truth. The wristwatch, Hastings. The wristwatch. Again, that wristwatch. Poirot was eyeing me curiously. "You see, mon ami? You comprehend?" "No," I replied with some ill humour. "I neither see nor comprehend. You make all these confounded mysteries, and it's useless asking you to explain. You always like keeping something up your sleeve to the last minute." "Do not enrage yourself, my friend," said Poirot, with a smile. "I will explain if you wish, but not a word to Giraud, c'est entendu? He treats me as an old one of no importance. We shall see. In common fairness, I gave him a hint. If he does not choose to act upon it, that is his own lookout." I assured Poirot that he could rely upon my discretion. "C'est bien. Let us then employ our little grey cells. Tell me, my friend, at what time, according to you, did the tragedy take place?"
"Why, at 2 o'clock or thereabouts," I said, astonished. "We remember, Mrs. Renault told us she heard the clock strike while the men were in the room."
"Exactly. And on the strength of that, you, the examining magistrate, Bex, and everyone else accept the time without further question. But I, Hercule Poirot, say that Madame Renault lied. The crime took place at least 2 hours earlier. But the doctors, they declared, after examination of the body, that death had taken place between 10 and 7 hours previously. Mon ami, for some reason, it was imperative that the crime should seem to have taken place later than it actually did. You have read of a smashed watch or clock recording the exact hour of a crime? So that the time should not rest on Madame Renault's testimony alone, someone moved on the hands of that wristwatch to 2 o'clock and then dashed it violently to the ground. But as is often the case, they defeated their own object. The glass was smashed, but the mechanism of the watch was uninjured. It was a most disastrous maneuver on their part, for it at once drew my attention to 2 points. First, that Madame Renault was lying. Second, that there must be some vital reason for the postponement of the time. But what reason could there be? Ah, that is the question. There we have the whole mystery. As yet, I cannot explain it,
There is only one idea that presents itself to me as having a possible connection, and that is? The last train left Merlinville at 12:17. I followed it out slowly. So that the crime, apparently taking place some 2 hours later, anyone leaving by that train would have an unimpeachable alibi. Perfect, Hastings. You have it.
I sprang up. But we must inquire at the station. Surely they cannot have failed to notice two foreigners who left by that train. We must go there at once.
You think so, Hastings? Of course. Let us go there now.
Poirot restrained my ardour with a light touch upon the arm.
Go by all means if you wish, mon ami. But if you go, I should not ask for particulars of two foreigners.
I stared, and he said rather impatiently,
La la, you do not believe all that rigmarole, do you?
The masked men, and all the rest of cette histoire-là? His words took me so much aback that I hardly knew how to respond. He went on serenely.
You heard me say to Giraud, did you not, that all the details of this crime were familiar to me?
Eh bien, that presupposes one of two things. Either the brain that planned the first crime also planned this one, or else an account read of a cause célèbre unconsciously remained in our assassin's memory and prompted the details. I shall be able to pronounce definitely on that after...
He broke off.
I was revolving sundry matters in my mind. But Mr. Renault's letter, it distinctly mentions a secret and Santiago.
Undoubtedly, there was a secret in Monsieur Renault's life. There can be no doubt of that. On the other hand, the word Santiago, to my mind, is a red herring, dragged continuously across the track to put us off the scent. It is possible that it was used in the same way on Monsieur Renault to keep him from directing his suspicions to a quarter nearer at hand. Oh, be assured, Hastings, the danger that threatened him was not in Santiago. It was near at hand, in France.
He spoke so gravely and with such assurance that I could not fail to be convinced. But I essayed one final objection.
And the match, and the cigarette end found near the body, what of them?
A light of pure enjoyment lit up Poirot's face.
Planted. Deliberately planted there for Giraud or one of his tribe to find.
Aha, he is smart, Giraud. He can do his tricks.
So can a good retriever dog. He comes in so pleased with himself. For hours he has crawled on his stomach. See what I have found, he says. And then again to me, what do you see here?
Me? I answer with profound and deep truth, nothing.
And Giraud, the great Giraud, he laughs. He thinks to himself, oh, he is imbecile, this old one.
But we shall see.
But my mind had reverted to the main facts. Then all this story of the masked men is false.
What really happened?
Poirot shrugged his shoulders.
One person could tell us, Madame Renault. But she will not speak. Threats and entreaties would not move her.
A remarkable woman, that Hastings. I recognized as soon as I saw her that I had to deal with a woman of unusual character. At first, as I told you, I was inclined to suspect her of being concerned in the crime. Afterwards, I altered my opinion.
What made you do that?
Her spontaneous and genuine grief at the sight of her husband's body. I could swear that the agony in that cry of hers was genuine.
Yes, I said thoughtfully, one cannot mistake these things.
I beg your pardon, my friend. One can always be mistaken. Regard a great actress. Does not her acting of grief carry you away and impress you with its reality?
No, however strong my own impression and belief, I needed other evidence before I allowed myself to be satisfied. The great criminal can be a great actor. I base my certainty in this case not upon my own impression, but upon the undeniable fact that Madame Renault actually fainted. I turned up her eyelids and felt her pulse. There was no deception. The swoon was genuine. Therefore, I was satisfied that her anguish was real and not assumed. Besides, a small additional point without interest, it was unnecessary for Madame Renault to exhibit unrestrained grief. She had had one paroxysm on learning of her husband's death, and there would be no need for her to simulate another, such a violent one, on beholding his body.
No. Madame Renault was not her husband's murderess.
But why has she lied?
She lied about the wristwatch. She lied about the masked men. She lied about a third thing.
Tell me, Hastings, what is your explanation of the open door?
Well, I said rather embarrassed, I suppose it was an oversight. They forgot to shut it.
Poirot shook his head and sighed. That is the explanation of Giraud. It does not satisfy me. There is a meaning behind that open door which for the moment I cannot fathom. One thing I am fairly sure of. They did not leave through the door. They left by the window.
What?
Precisely. But there were no footmarks in the flowerbed underneath.
No.
There ought to have been. Listen, Hastings. The gardener, Auguste, as you heard him say, planted both those beds the preceding afternoon. In the one, there are plentiful impressions of his big hobnailed boots. In the other, none. You see? Someone had passed that way. Someone who, to obliterate their footprints, smoothed over the surface of the bed with a rake.
Where did they get a rake?
Where they got the spade and the gardening gloves,
said Poirot impatiently.
There is no difficulty about that.
What makes you think that they left that way, though?
Well, surely it's more probable that they entered by the window and left by the door.
That is possible, of course. Yet I have a strong idea that they left by the window.
I think you're wrong.
Perhaps, mon ami. I mused, thinking over the new field of conjecture that Poirot's deductions had opened up to me. I recalled my wonder at his cryptic allusion to the flowerbed and the wristwatch. His remarks had seemed so meaningless at the moment, and now, for the first time, I realized how remarkably, from a few slight incidents, he had unraveled much of the mystery that surrounded the case. I paid a belated homage to my friend. In the meantime, I said, considering, although we know a great deal more than we did, we are no nearer to solving the mystery of who killed Mr. Renault.
No, said Poirot cheerfully. In fact, we are a great deal further off.
The fact seemed to afford him such peculiar satisfaction that I gazed at him in wonder. He met my eye and smiled. Suddenly, a light burst upon me.
Poirot! Mrs. Renault! I see it now. She must be shielding somebody.
From the quietness with which Poirot received my remark, I could see that the idea had already occurred to him.
Yes, he said thoughtfully. Shielding someone, or screening someone. One of the two.
Then, as we entered our hotel, he enjoined silence on me with a gesture.
Chapter 13. The Girl with the Anxious Eyes. We lunched with an excellent appetite. For a while we ate in silence, and then Poirot observed maliciously,
Eh bien, and your indiscretions, you recount them not?
I felt myself blushing.
Oh, you mean this morning?
I endeavoured to adopt a tone of absolute nonchalance, but I was no match for Poirot. In a few minutes he had extracted the whole story from me, his eyes twinkling as he did so.
Tiens, a story of the most romantic. What is her name, this charming young lady?
I had to confess that I did not know.
Still more romantic. The first rencontre in the train from Paris, the second here. Journey's end in lovers' meetings. Is that not the saying?
Don't be an ass, Poirot.
Yesterday it was Mademoiselle de Breuil. Today it is Mademoiselle Cinderella. Decidedly you have the heart of a Turk, Hastings. You should establish a harem.
It's all very well to rag me. Mademoiselle de Breuil is a very beautiful girl, and I do admire her immensely. I don't mind admitting it. The other's nothing. I don't suppose I shall ever see her again.
You do not propose to see the lady again?
His last words were almost a question, and I was aware of the sharpness with which he darted a glance at me. Before my eyes, writ large in letters of fire, I saw the words, Hotel du Phare, and I heard again her voice saying, Come and look me up, and my own answering with empressement, I will. I answered Poirot lightly enough.
She asked me to look her up, but of course I shan't.
Why, of course?
Well, I don't want to.
Mademoiselle Cinderella is staying at the Hôtel d'Angleterre, you told me, did you not?
No, Hôtel du Phare.
True, I forgot. A moment's misgiving shot across my mind. Surely I had never mentioned any hotel to Poirot. I looked across at him and felt reassured. He was cutting his bread into neat little squares, completely absorbed in his task. He must have fancied I had told him where the girl was staying. We had coffee outside, facing the sea. Poirot smoked one of his tiny cigarettes, and then drew his watch from his pocket.
The train to Paris leaves at 2:25, he observed. I should be starting.
Paris? I cried. That is what I said, mon ami.
You're going to Paris? But why?
He replied very seriously.
to look for the murderer of Monsieur Renaud.
You think he's in Paris?
I am quite certain that he is not. Nevertheless, it is there that I must look for him. You do not understand, but I will explain it all to you in good time. Believe me, this journey to Paris is necessary. I shall not be away long. In all probability, I shall return tomorrow. I do not propose that you should accompany me. Remain here and keep an eye on Giraud. Also, cultivate the society of Monsieur Renaud Fils.
Oh, that reminds me, I said. I meant to ask you how you knew about those two.
Mon ami, I know human nature. Throw together a boy like young Renaud and a beautiful girl like Mademoiselle Marthe, and the result is almost inevitable. Then the quarrel. It was money, or a woman, and remembering Léonie's description of the lad's anger, I decided on the latter. So I made my guess, and I was right.
You already suspected that she loved young Renaud?
Poirot smiled. At any rate, I saw that she had anxious eyes. That is how I always think of Mademoiselle d'Aubray, as the girl with the anxious eyes.
His voice was so grave that it impressed me uncomfortably. What do you mean by that, Poirot?
I fancy, my friend, that we shall see, before very long. But I must start.
I will come and see you off, I said, rising.
You will do nothing of the sort. I forbid it.
He was so peremptory that I stared at him in surprise. He nodded emphatically. I mean it, mon ami. Au revoir.
I felt rather at a loose end after Poirot had left me. I strolled down to the beach and watched the bathers, without feeling energetic enough to join them. I rather fancied that Cinderella might be disporting herself among them in some wonderful costume, but I saw no signs of her. I strolled aimlessly along the sands towards the farther end of town. It occurred to me that, after all, it would only be decent feeling on my part to inquire after the girl. And it would save trouble in the end. The matter would then be finished with. There would be no need for me to trouble about her any further. But if I did not go at all, she might quite possibly come and look me up at the villa. Accordingly, I left the beach and walked inland. I soon found the Hotel du Phare, a very unpretentious building. It was annoying in the extreme not to know the lady's name, and to save my dignity, I decided to stroll inside and look around. Probably I should find her in the lounge. I went in, but there was no sign of her. I waited for some time, till my impatience got the better of me. I took the concierge aside and slipped 5 francs into his hand.
I wish to see a lady who is staying here. A young English lady, small and dark. I am not sure of her name.
The man shook his head and seemed to be suppressing a grin.
There is no such lady as you describe staying here.
But the lady told me she was staying here.
Monsieur, you must have made a mistake. Or it is more likely the lady did, since there has been another gentleman here inquiring for her.
What is that you say? I cried, surprised.
But yes, monsieur, a gentleman who described her just as you have done.
What was he like?
He was a small gentleman. Well-dressed, very neat, very spotless, the moustache very stiff, the head of a peculiar shape, and eyes green.
Poirot! So that was why he refused to let me accompany him to the station. The impertinence of it! I would thank him not to meddle in my concerns. Did he fancy I needed a nurse to look after me?
Thanking the man, I departed, somewhat at a loss, and still much incensed with my meddlesome friend. But where was the lady? I set aside my wrath, and tried to puzzle it out. Evidently, through inadvertence, she had named the wrong hotel. Then another thought struck me. Was it inadvertence? Or had she deliberately withheld her name and given me the wrong address? The more I thought about it, the more I felt convinced that this last surmise of mine was right. For some reason or other, she did not wish to let the acquaintance ripen into friendship. And though, half an hour earlier, this had been precisely my own view, I did not enjoy having the tables turned upon me. The whole affair was profoundly unsatisfactory, and I went up to the Villa Genevieve in a condition of distinct ill-humour. I did not go to the house, but went up the path to the little bench by the shed, and sat there moodily enough. I was distracted from my thoughts by the sound of voices close at hand. In a second or two I realised that they came not from the garden I was in, but from the adjoining garden of the Villa Marguerite, and that they were approaching rapidly. A girl's voice was speaking, a voice that I recognized as that of the beautiful martyr.
"Chérie," she was saying, "is it really true? Are all our troubles over?"
"You know it, martyr," Jack Renaud replied.
Nothing can part us now, beloved. The last obstacle to our union is removed. Nothing can take you from me.
Nothing?
The girl murmured. Oh, Jack. Oh, Jack, I am afraid. I had moved to depart, realizing that I was quite unintentionally eavesdropping. As I rose to my feet, I caught sight of them through a gap in the hedge. They stood together, facing me. The man's arm round the girl, his eyes looking into hers. They were a splendid-looking couple. The dark, well-knit boy and the fair young goddess. They seemed made for each other as they stood there, happy in spite of the terrible tragedy that overshadowed their young lives. But the girl's face was troubled, and Jack Renault seemed to recognize it as he held her closer to him and asked, "But what are you afraid of, darling? What is there to fear now?" And then I saw the look in her eyes, the look Poirot had spoken of, as she murmured so that I almost guessed at the words,
"I am afraid for you."
I did not hear young Renault's answer, for my attention was distracted by an unusual appearance a little farther down the hedge. There appeared to be a brown bush there, which seemed odd, to say the least of it, so early in the summer. I stepped along to investigate, but at my advance the brown bush withdrew itself precipitately and faced me with a finger to its lips. It was Giraud. Enjoining caution, he led the way round the shed until we were out of earshot.
"What were you doing there?" I asked.
"Exactly what you were doing, listening. But I was not there on purpose."
"Ah," said Giraud, "I was."
As always, I admired the man while disliking him. He looked me up and down with a sort of contemptuous disfavour.
"You didn't help matters by butting in. I might have heard something useful in a minute. What have you done with your old fossil?"
"Monsieur Poirot has gone to Paris," I replied coldly. Giraud snapped his fingers disdainfully.
"So, he has gone to Paris, has he? Well, a good thing. The longer he stays there, the better. But what does he think he will find there?"
I thought I read in the question a tinge of uneasiness. I drew myself up.
"That I am not at liberty to say," I said quietly.
Giraud subjected me to a piercing stare.
"He has probably enough sense not to tell you," he remarked rudely. "Good afternoon, I'm busy."
And with that he turned on his heel and left me without ceremony. Matters seemed at a standstill at the Villa Genevieve. Giraud evidently did not desire my company, and from what I had seen it seemed fairly certain that Jack Renault did not either. I went back to the town, had an enjoyable bathe, and returned to the hotel. I turned in early, wondering whether the following day would bring forth anything of interest. I was wholly unprepared for what it did bring forth. I was eating my petit déjeuner in the dining room when the waiter, who had been talking to someone outside, came back in obvious excitement. He hesitated for a minute, fidgeting with his napkin, and then burst out,
"Monsieur will pardon me, but he is connected, is he not, with the affair at the Villa Genevieve?"
"Yes," I said eagerly. "Why?"
"Monsieur has not heard the news, though."
"What news?"
"That there has been another murder there last night."
"What?" Leaving my breakfast, I caught up my hat and ran as fast as I could.
Another murder, and Poirot away! What fatality! But who had been murdered?
I dashed in at the gate. A group of servants were in the drive, talking and gesticulating. I caught hold of Françoise.
"What has happened?" "Oh, monsieur, monsieur, another death! It is terrible! There is a curse upon the house. But yes, I say it, a curse! They should send for Monsieur le Curé to bring some holy water. Never will I sleep another night under that roof. It might be my turn. Who knows?"
She crossed herself.
"Yes," I cried, "but who has been killed?" "Do I know me? A man, a stranger. They found him up there in the shed, not 100 yards from where they found poor Monsieur. And that is not all. He is stabbed, stabbed to the heart with the same dagger."
Chapter 14. The Second Body. Waiting for no more, I turned and ran up the path to the shed. The two men on guard there stood aside to let me pass, and filled with excitement, I entered. The light was dim. The place was a mere rough wooden erection to keep old pots and tools in. I had entered impetuously, but on the threshold I checked myself, fascinated by the spectacle before me. Giraud was on his hands and knees, a pocket torch in his hand, with which he was examining every inch of the ground. He looked up with a frown at my entrance. Then his face relaxed a little in a sort of good-humoured contempt.
"There he is," said Giraud, flashing his torch to the far corner.
I stepped across.
The dead man lay straight upon his back. He was of medium height, swarthy of complexion, and possibly about 50 years of age. He was neatly dressed in a dark blue suit, well cut and probably made by an expensive tailor, but not new. His face was terribly convulsed, and on his left side, just over the heart, the hilt of a dagger stood up, black and shining. I recognized it. It was the same dagger I had seen reposing in the glass jar the preceding morning.
"I am expecting the doctor any minute," explained Giraud, "although we hardly need him. There is no doubt what the man died of. He was stabbed to the heart, and death must have been pretty well instantaneous."
"When was it done? Last night?"
Giraud shook his head. "Hardly. I don't lay down the law on medical evidence, but the man's been dead well over 12 hours. When do you say you last saw that dagger?"
"About 10 o'clock yesterday morning."
"Then I should be inclined to fix the crime as being done not long after that."
"But people were passing and repassing this shed continually."
Giraud laughed disagreeably. "You progress to a marvel. Who told you he was killed in this shed?"
"Well," I felt flustered, I assumed it."
"Oh, what a fine detective. Look at him. Does a man stabbed to the heart fall like that, neatly, with his feet together and his arms to his sides? No. Again, does a man lie down on his back and permit himself to be stabbed without raising a hand to defend himself? It is absurd, is it not? But see here, and here." He flashed the torch along the ground.
I saw curious irregular marks in the soft dirt.
"He was dragged here after he was dead, half dragged, half carried by 2 people. Their tracks do not show on the hard ground outside, and here they have been careful to obliterate them. But one of the 2 was a woman, my young friend."
"A woman?"
"Yes.
But if the tracks are obliterated, how do you know?"
"Because, blurred as they are, the prints of the woman's shoe are unmistakable. Also, by this."
And leaning forward, he drew something from the handle of the dagger and held it up for me to see. It was a woman's long black hair, similar to the one Poirot had taken from the armchair in the library. With a slightly ironic smile, he wound it round the dagger again.
"We will leave things as they are as much as possible," he explained. "It pleases the examining magistrate. Well, do you notice anything else?"
I was forced to shake my head.
"Look at his hands."
I did. The nails were broken and discolored, and the skin was hard. It hardly enlightened me as much as I should have liked it to have done. I looked up at Giraud.
"They are not the hands of a gentleman," he said, answering my look. "On the contrary, his clothes are those of a well-to-do man. That is curious, is it not?"
"Very curious," I agreed.
"And none of his clothing is marked. What do we learn from that? This man was trying to pass himself off as other than he was. He was masquerading. Why? Did he fear something? Was he trying to escape by disguising himself? As yet we do not know, but one thing we do know, he was as anxious to conceal his identity as we are to discover it."
He looked down at the body again.
"As before, there are no fingerprints on the handle of the dagger. The murderer again wore gloves."
"You think then that the murderer was the same in both cases?" I asked eagerly. Giraud became inscrutable.
"Never mind what I think. We shall see. Marchaud?"
The sergeant de ville appeared at the door.
"Monsieur?"
"Why is Madame Renaud not here? I sent for her 1/4 hour ago.
"She is coming up the path now, monsieur, and her son with her."
"Good. I only want 1 at a time, though."
Marchaud saluted and disappeared again. A moment later, he reappeared with Mrs. Renaud.
"Here is Madame."
Giraud came forward with a curt bow.
"This way, Madame."
He led her across, and then, standing suddenly aside,
"Here is the man. Do you know him?"
And as he spoke, his eyes, gimlet-like, bored into her face, seeking to read her mind, noting every indication of her manner. But Mrs. Renaud remained perfectly calm. Too calm, I felt. She looked down at the corpse almost without interest, certainly without any sign of agitation or recognition.
"No," she said. "I have never seen him in my life. He is quite a stranger to me."
"You are sure?"
"Quite sure."
"You do not recognize in him one of your assailants, for instance?"
"No."
She seemed to hesitate, as though struck by the idea.
"No, I do not think so."
Of course, they wore beards. False ones, the examining magistrate thought, but still. No. Now she seemed to make up her mind definitely. I am sure neither of the two was this man.
Very well, madame. That is all, then.
She stepped out with head erect, the sun flashing on the silver threads in her hair. Jack Renault succeeded her. He, too, failed to identify the man in a completely natural manner. Jerome merely grunted. Whether he was pleased or chagrined, I could not tell. He called to Marchaud.
You have got the other there?
Yes, monsieur.
Bring her in, then.
The other was Madame Daubreuil. She came indignantly, protesting with vehemence.
I object, monsieur. This is an outrage. What have I to do with all this?
Madame, said Giraud brutally, I am investigating not one murder, but two murders. For all I know, you may have committed them both.
How dare you, she cried. How dare you insult me by such a wild accusation? It is infamous.
Infamous, is it? What about this?
Stooping, he again detached the hair and held it up.
Do you see this, madame?
He advanced towards her.
You permit that I see whether it matches?
With a cry, she started backwards, white to the lips.
It is false. I swear it. I know nothing of the crime, of either crime. Anyone who says I do, lies. Ah, mon Dieu, what shall I do?
Calm yourself, madame, said Giraud coldly. No one has accused you as yet, but you will do well to answer my questions without more ado.
Anything you wish, monsieur.
Look at the dead man. Have you ever seen him before? Drawing nearer, a little of the colour creeping back into her face, Madame Daubreuil looked down at the victim with a certain amount of interest and curiosity. Then she shook her head.
I do not know him.
It seemed impossible to doubt her. The words came so naturally. Giraud dismissed her with a nod of the head.
You're letting her go?
I asked in a low voice. Is that wise? Surely that black hair is from her head.
I do not need teaching my business, said Giraud dryly. She is under surveillance. I have no wish to arrest her as yet.
Then, frowning, he gazed down at the body.
Should you say that was a Spanish type at all?
He asked suddenly. I considered the face carefully. No, I said at last. I should put him down as a Frenchman, most decidedly. Giraud gave a grunt of dissatisfaction.
Same here.
He stood there for a moment. Then, with an imperative gesture, he waved me aside, and once more, on hands and knees, he continued his search of the floor of the shed. He was marvellous. Nothing escaped him. Inch by inch he went over the floor, turning over pots, examining old sacks. He pounced on a bundle by the door, but it proved to be only a ragged coat and trousers, and he flung it down again with a snarl. Two pairs of old gloves interested him, but in the end he shook his head and laid them aside. Then he went back to the pots, methodically turning them over one by one. In the end he rose to his feet and shook his head thoughtfully. He seemed baffled and perplexed. I think he had forgotten my presence. But at that moment a stir and bustle was heard outside, and our old friend, the examining magistrate, accompanied by his clerk and Monsieur Bex, with the doctor behind them, came bustling in.
"But this is extraordinary, Monsieur Giraud," cried Monsieur Hotet. "Another crime! Ah, we have not got to the bottom of this case. There is some deep mystery here. But who is the victim this time?"
"That is just what nobody can tell us, monsieur. He has not been identified."
"Where is the body?"
asked the doctor. Giraud moved aside a little.
"There, in the corner. He has been stabbed to the heart, as you see, and with the dagger that was stolen yesterday morning. I fancy that the murder followed hard upon the theft, but that is for you to say. You can handle the dagger freely. There are no fingerprints on it."
The doctor knelt down by the dead man, and Giraud turned to the examining magistrate.
"A pretty little problem, is it not? But I shall solve it."
"And so, no one can identify him," mused the magistrate. "Could it possibly be one of the assassins? They may have fallen out amongst themselves."
Giraud shook his head. "The man is a Frenchman. I would take my oath on that." But at that moment they were interrupted by the doctor, who was sitting back on his heels with a perplexed expression.
"You say he was killed yesterday morning?"
"I fix it by the theft of the dagger," explained Giraud. "He may, of course, have been killed later in the day."
Later in the day, fiddlesticks. This man has been dead at least 48 hours, and probably longer.
We stared at each other in blank amazement. Chapter 15. A Photograph. The doctor's words were so surprising that we were all momentarily taken aback. Here was a man stabbed with a dagger, which we knew to have been stolen only 24 hours previously. And yet, Dr. Durand asserted positively that he'd been dead at least 48 hours. The whole thing was fantastic to the last extreme. We were still recovering from the surprise of the doctor's announcement when a telegram was brought to me. It had been sent up from the hotel to the villa. I tore it open. It was from Poirot, and announced his return by the train arriving at Merlinville at 12:28. I looked at my watch and saw that I had just time to get comfortably to the station and meet him there. I felt that it was of the utmost importance that he should know at once of the new and startling developments in the case. Evidently, I reflected, Poirot had had no difficulty in finding what he wanted in Paris. The quickness of his return proved that. Very few hours had sufficed. I wondered how he would take the exciting news I had to impart. The train was some minutes late, and I strolled aimlessly up and down the platform, until it occurred to me that I might pass the time by asking a few questions as to who had left Merlinville by the last train on the evening of the tragedy. I approached the chief porter, an intelligent-looking man, and had little difficulty in persuading him to enter upon the subject. It was a disgrace to the police, he hotly affirmed, that such brigands or assassins should be allowed to go about unpunished. I hinted that there was some possibility they might have left by the midnight train, but he negatived the idea decidedly. He would have noticed 2 foreigners, he was sure of it. Only about 20 people had left by the train, and he could not have failed to observe them. I do not know what put the idea into my head. Possibly it was the deep anxiety underlying Marthe Dobreuil's tones, but I asked suddenly, "Young Monsieur Renault, he did not leave by that train, did he?"
"Ah, no, monsieur. To arrive and start off again within 30 minutes, it would not be amusing, that."
I stared at the man, the significance of his words almost escaping me. Then I saw.
"You mean," I said, my heart beating a little, "that Monsieur Jacques Renault arrived at Merlinville that evening?" "But yes, monsieur, by the last train arriving the other way, the 11:40.
My brain whirled. That, then, was the reason of Marta's poignant anxiety. Jacques Renault had been in Merlinville on the night of the crime. But why had he not said so? Why, on the contrary, had he led us to believe that he had remained in Cherbourg? Remembering his frank, boyish countenance, I could hardly bring myself to believe that he had any connection with the crime. Yet why this silence on his part about so vital a matter? One thing was certain. Marta had known all along. Hence her anxiety, and her eager questioning of Poirot as to whether anyone was suspected. My cogitations were interrupted by the arrival of the train, and in another moment I was greeting Poirot. The little man was radiant. He beamed and vociferated, and forgetting my English reluctance, embraced me warmly on the platform.
"Mon cher ami, I have succeeded, but succeeded to a marvel.
Indeed, I'm delighted to hear it. Have you heard the latest here?"
"How would you that I should hear anything? There have been developments, sir? The brave Giraud, he has made an arrest, or even arrests, perhaps? Ah, but I will make him look foolish, that one.
But where are you taking me, my friend? Do we not go to the hotel? It is necessary that I tend to my moustaches. They are deplorably limp from the heat of travelling. Also, without doubt, there is dust on my coat, and my tie, that I must rearrange."
I cut short his remonstrances. "My dear Poirot, never mind all that. We must go to the villa at once. There has been another murder." Never have I seen a man so flabbergasted. His jaw dropped. All the jauntiness went out of his bearing. He stared at me open-mouthed.
"What is that you say? Another murder? Ah, then, but I am all wrong. I have failed. Giraud may mock himself at me. He will have reason."
"You did not expect it, then?"
"I? Not the least in the world. It demolishes my theory. It ruins everything. No.
He stopped dead, thumping himself on the chest.
"It is impossible. I cannot be wrong.
The facts, taken methodically and in their proper order, admit of only one explanation. I must be right. I am right. But then, he interrupted me, wait, my friend, I must be right. Therefore, this new murder is impossible, unless—oh, wait, I implore you, say no word. He was silent for a moment or two. Then, resuming his normal manner, he said in a quiet, assured voice, the victim is a man of middle age. His body was found in a locked shed near the scene of the crime and had been dead at least 48 hours, and it is most probable that he was stabbed in a similar manner to Monsieur Renaud, though not necessarily in the back. It was my turn to gape, and gape I did. In all my knowledge of Poirot, he had never done anything so amazing as this, and almost inevitably, a doubt crossed my mind. Poirot, I cried, you're pulling my leg. You've heard all about it already. He turned his earnest gaze upon me reproachfully. Would I do such a thing? I assure you that I have heard nothing whatsoever. Did you not observe the shock your news was to me? But how on earth could you know all that? I was right then, but I knew it. The little grey cells, my friend, the little grey cells, they told me. Thus, and in no other way, could there have been a second death. Now, tell me all. If we go round to the left here, we can take a shortcut across the golf links, which will bring us to the back of the Villa Genevieve much more quickly. As we walked, taking the way he had indicated, I recounted all I knew. Poirot listened attentively. The dagger was in the wound, you say? That is curious. You are sure it was the same one? Absolutely certain. That's what makes it so impossible. Nothing is impossible. There may have been two daggers. I raised my eyebrows. Surely that is in the highest degree unlikely. It would be a most extraordinary coincidence. You speak as usual without reflection, Hastings. In some cases, two identical weapons would be highly improbable, but not here. This particular weapon was a war souvenir, which was made to Jack Renault's orders. It is really highly unlikely, when you come to think of it, that he should have had only one made. Very probably he would have another for his own use. But nobody's mentioned such a thing, I objected. A hint of the lecturer crept into Poirot's tone. My friend, in working upon a case, one does not take into account only the things that are mentioned. There is no reason to mention many things which may be important. Equally, there is often an excellent reason for not mentioning them. You can take your choice of the two motives. I was silent, impressed in spite of myself. Another few minutes brought us to the famous shed. We found all our friends there, and after an interchange of polite amenities, Poirot began his task. Having watched Giraud at work, I was keenly interested. Poirot bestowed but a cursory glance on the surroundings. The only thing he examined was the ragged coat and trousers by the door. A disdainful smile rose to Giraud's lips, and as though noting it, Poirot flung the bundle down again. "Old clothes of the gardeners?" he queried. "Exactly," said Giraud. Poirot knelt down by the body. His fingers were rapid but methodical. He examined the texture of the clothes and satisfied himself that there were no marks on them. The boots he subjected to special care, also the dirty and broken fingernails. While examining the latter, he threw a quick question at Giraud. "You saw them?" "Yes, I saw them," replied the other. His face remained inscrutable. Suddenly, Poirot stiffened. "Dr. Durand!" "Yes?" The doctor came forward. "There is foam on the lips. You observe it?" "I didn't notice it, I must admit." "But you observe it now?" "Oh, certainly." Poirot again shot a question at Giraud. "You noticed it without doubt?" The other did not reply. Poirot proceeded. The dagger had been withdrawn from the wound. It reposed in a glass jar by the side of the body. Poirot examined it. Then he studied the wound closely. When he looked up, his eyes were excited and shone with the green light I knew so well. "It is a strange wound, this. It has not bled. There is no stain on the clothes. The blade of the dagger is slightly discolored, that is all. What do you think, Monsieur le Docteur?"
"I can only say that it is most abnormal."
"It is not abnormal at all. It is most simple.
The man was stabbed after he was dead. And stilling the clamour of voices that arose with a wave of his hand, Poirot turned to Giraud and added, "Monsieur Giraud agrees with me, do you not, monsieur?" Whatever Giraud's real belief, he accepted the position without moving a muscle. Calmly, and almost scornfully, he replied, "Certainly, I agree." The murmur of surprise and interest broke out again.
"But what an idea," cried Monsieur Hotet, "to stab a man after he is dead, barbaric, unheard of, some unappeasable hate, perhaps?"
"No," said Poirot, "I should fancy it was done quite cold-bloodedly to create an impression."
"What impression?"
"The impression it nearly did create," returned Poirot oracularly.
Monsieur Bex had been thinking.
"How then was the man killed?"
"He was not killed. He died.
He died, if I am not much mistaken, of an epileptic fit."
This statement of Poirot's again caused considerable excitement. Dr. Durand knelt down again and made a searching examination. At last he rose to his feet.
"Monsieur Poirot, I am inclined to believe that you are correct in your assertion. I was misled to begin with.
The incontrovertible fact that the man had been stabbed distracted my attention from any other indications."
Poirot was the hero of the hour. The examining magistrate was profuse in compliments. Poirot responded gracefully, and then excused himself on the pretext that neither he nor I had yet lunched, and that he wished to repair the ravages of the journey. As we were about to leave the shed, Giraud approached us.
"One other thing, Monsieur Poirot," he said in his suave, mocking voice. "We found this, coiled round the handle of the dagger. A woman's hair."
"Ah," said Poirot.
"A woman's hair? What woman's, I wonder?" "I wonder also," said Giraud.
Then, with a bow, he left us.
"He was insistent, the good Giraud," said Poirot thoughtfully as we walked towards the hotel. "I wonder in what direction he hopes to mislead me. A woman's hair.
We lunched heartily, but I found Poirot somewhat distray and inattentive. Afterwards, we went up to our sitting room, and there I begged him to tell me something of his mysterious journey to Paris.
"Willingly, my friend. I went to Paris to find this."
He took from his pocket a small, faded newspaper cutting. It was the reproduction of a woman's photograph. He handed it to me. I uttered an exclamation.
"You recognize it, my friend?"
I nodded. Although the photo obviously dated from many, many years back, and the hair was dressed in a different style, the likeness was unmistakable.
"Madame de Breuil!" I exclaimed.
Poirot shook his head with a smile.
"Not quite correct, my friend. She did not call herself by that name in those days. That is a picture of the notorious Madame Beroldi."
"Madame Beroldi!"
In a flash, the whole thing came back to me. The murder trial that had evoked such worldwide interest, the Beroldi case. Chapter 16. The Beroldi Case. Some 20 years or so before the opening of the present story, Monsieur Arnold Beroldi, a native of Lyon, arrived in Paris accompanied by his pretty wife and their little daughter, a mere babe. Monsieur Beroldi was a junior partner in a firm of wine merchants, a stout, middle-aged man, fond of the good things of life, devoted to his charming wife, and altogether unremarkable in every way. The firm, in which Monsieur Beroldi was a partner, was a small one, and although doing well, it did not yield a large income to the junior partner. The Beroldis had a small apartment, and lived in a very modest fashion, to begin with. But unremarkable though Monsieur Beroldi might be, his wife was plentifully gilded with the brush of romance. Young and good-looking, and gifted withal with a singular charm of manner, Madame Beroldi at once created a stir in the quarter, especially when it began to be whispered that some interesting mystery surrounded her birth. It was rumoured that she was the illegitimate daughter of a Russian Grand Duke. Others asserted that it was an Austrian Archduke, and that the union was legal, though morganatic. But all stories agreed upon one point, that Jeanne Beroldi was the centre of an interesting mystery. Among the friends and acquaintances of the Beroldis was a young lawyer, Georges Corneau. It was soon evident that the fascinating Jeanne had completely enslaved his heart.
Madame Beroldi encouraged the young man in a discreet fashion, but always being careful to affirm her complete devotion to her middle-aged husband. Nevertheless, many spiteful persons did not hesitate to declare that young Conneau was her lover, and not the only one. When the Beroldis had been in Paris about 3 months, another personage came upon the scene. This was Mr. Hiram P. Trapp, a native of the United States, and extremely wealthy. Introduced to the charming and mysterious Madame Beroldi, he fell a prompt victim to her fascinations. His admiration was obvious, though strictly respectful. About this time, Madame Beroldi became more outspoken in her confidences. To several friends, she declared herself greatly worried on her husband's behalf. She explained that he had been drawn into several schemes of a political nature, and also referred to some important papers that had been entrusted to him for safekeeping, and which concerned a secret of far-reaching European importance. They had been entrusted to his custody to throw pursuers off the track, but Madame Beroldi was nervous, having recognized several important members of the revolutionary circle in Paris. On the 28th day of November, the blow fell. The woman, who came daily to clean and cook for the Beroldis, was surprised to find the door of the apartment standing wide open. Hearing faint moans issuing from the bedroom, she went in. A terrible sight met her eyes. Madame Beroldi lay on the floor, bound hand and foot, uttering feeble moans, having managed to free her mouth from a gag. On the bed was Monsieur Beroldi, lying in a pool of blood, with a knife driven through his heart. Madame Beroldi's story was clear enough. Suddenly awakened from sleep, she had discerned two masked men bending over her. Stifling her cries, they had bound and gagged her. They had then demanded of Monsieur Beroldi the famous secret. But the intrepid wine merchant refused point-blank to accede to their request. Angered by his refusal, one of the men incontinently stabbed him through the heart. With the dead man's keys, they had opened the safe in the corner, and had carried away with them a mass of papers. Both men were heavily bearded, and had worn masks, but Madame Beroldi declared positively that they were Russians. The affair created an immense sensation. Time went on, and the mysterious bearded men were never traced. And then, just as public interest was beginning to die down, a startling development occurred. Madame Beroldi was arrested and charged with the murder of her husband. The trial, when it came on, aroused widespread interest. The youth and beauty of the accused and her mysterious history were sufficient to make of it a cause célèbre. It was proved beyond doubt that Jeanne Beroldi's parents were a highly respectable and prosaic couple, fruit merchants who lived on the outskirts of Lyon. The Russian Grand Duke, the court intrigues, and the political schemes, all the stories current, were traced back to the lady herself. Remorselessly, the whole story of her life was laid bare. The motive for the murder was found in Mr. Hiram P. Trapp. Mr. Trapp did his best, but relentlessly and agilely cross-questioned, he was forced to admit that he loved the lady, and that, had she been free, he would have asked her to be his wife. The fact that the relations between them were admittedly platonic strengthened the case against the accused. Debarred from becoming his mistress by the simple, honorable nature of the man, Jeanne Beroldi had conceived the monstrous project of ridding herself of her elderly, undistinguished husband and becoming the wife of the rich American. Throughout, Madame Beroldi confronted her accusers with complete sang-froid and self-possession. Her story never varied. She continued to declare strenuously that she was of royal birth and that she had been substituted for the daughter of the fruit seller at an early age. Absurd and completely unsubstantiated as these statements were, a great number of people believed implicitly in their truth. But the prosecution was implacable. It denounced the masked Russians as a myth and asserted that the crime had been committed by Madame Beroldi and her lover, Georges Conneau. A warrant was issued for the arrest of the latter, but he had wisely disappeared. Evidence showed that the bonds which had secured Madame Beroldi were so loose that she could easily have freed herself. And then, towards the close of the trial, a letter, posted in Paris, was sent to the public prosecutor. It was from Georges Conneau, and without revealing his whereabouts, it contained a full confession of the crime. He declared that he had indeed struck the fatal blow at Madame Beroldi's instigation. The crime had been planned between them. Believing that her husband ill-treated her, and maddened by his own passion for her, a passion which he believed her to return, he had planned the crime and struck the fatal blow that should free the woman he loved from a hateful bondage. Now, for the first time, he learnt of Mr. Hiram P. Trapp and realized that the woman he loved had betrayed him. Not for his sake did she wish to be free, but in order to marry the wealthy American. She had used him as a cat's paw, and now, in his jealous rage, he turned and denounced her, declaring that throughout he had acted at her instigation. And then, Madame Baroldi proved herself the remarkable woman she undoubtedly was. Without hesitation, she dropped her previous defense and admitted that the Russians were a pure invention on her part. The real murderer was Georges Corneau. Maddened by passion, he had committed the crime, vowing that if she did not keep silence, he would exact a terrible vengeance from her. Terrified by his threats, she had consented, also fearing it likely that if she told the truth, she might be accused of conniving at the crime, but she had steadfastly refused to have anything more to do with her husband's murderer, and it was in revenge for this attitude on her part that he had written this letter accusing her. She swore solemnly that she had had nothing to do with the planning of the crime, that she had awoke on that memorable night to find Georges Corneau standing over her, the blood-stained knife in his hand. It was a touch-and-go affair. Madame Baroldi's story was hardly credible, but her address to the jury was a masterpiece. The tears streaming down her face, she spoke of her child, of her woman's honor, of her desire to keep her reputation untarnished for the child's sake. She admitted that Georges Corneau, having been her lover, she might perhaps be held morally responsible for the crime, but before God, nothing more. She knew that she had committed a grave fault in not denouncing Corneau to the law, but she declared in a broken voice that that was a thing no woman could have done. She had loved him. Could she let her hand be the one to send him to the guillotine? She had been guilty of much, but she was innocent of the terrible crime imputed to her. However that may have been, her eloquence and personality won the day. Madame Baroldi, amidst a scene of unparalleled excitement, was acquitted. Despite the utmost endeavors of the police, Georges Corneau was never traced. As for Madame Baroldi, nothing more was heard of her. Taking the child with her, she left Paris to begin a new life.